Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Election 2020, the race for House, Senate, and White House. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy at Amherst Pierpont. This is the first of a series of conference calls on Election 2020 and its implications for the capital markets. We have the good luck to bring you some of the country's leading experts on politics and policy, so you can start framing the upcoming elections and their impact on your business. This election has clearly captured the attention of markets. The interest rate options market, by some measures, is pricing in more than four times the post-election volatility priced at this point for the presidential elections of 2012 or 2016, and more than two times the volatility priced in at this point for the midterm 2018 elections. Google Trends data shows much higher interest at this point than in any of those elections, too. Part of the reason for the close attention has to be the significant divide between the two major parties. VoteView.com from the UCLA Department of Political Science shows the ideological split between the new two major parties at its widest point in U.S. history. Some of the areas important to markets where policy could shift after November 3 includes taxes, spending, management of the deficit, and the direction of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, just to name a few. We are joined today by Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics, which has often led the way in using polling and other good data to get a view of the political landscape. Tom will take about 20 to 30 minutes to show us the territory ahead in the 48 days until November 3rd. After Tom's remarks, we will take questions from the audience. You will notice on the right side of your webinar screen a chat box for submitting questions. You can submit them at any time during this call, and we will put them in the queue for when Q&A begins. With that, Tom, I'll hand it over to you for a review of all the fun between now and November 3rd. Take it away.
Great. Thank you, Steve. And I'd like to thank Steve and all of his folks at Amherst for inviting me back to speak. It's an honor and a pleasure. So what I'm going to do is I've got some slides that we're going to run through. And talk about, sort of start by just talking about the political landscape, where we are, and then drill down on the presidential race and some of these Senate races, and we'll conclude by talking a little bit about the House and about what lies ahead after November 3rd. So with that, we can begin. And really, you know, I actually was able to speak to an Amherst group in January of this year, and which was only 8 months ago or so. And there's a meme that if you guys have social media, you'll know there was a meme that took off right around May after COVID hit, talking about how we all had plans for 2020, and then there's the reality. And you can see here, this is one of my favorites because I'm a fan of The Office. Kevin made his big bucket of chili. Came to the office, and that's what 2020 looks like. There's another one here that's a sort of classic of the genre. But it's very much the case with our politics and this political, this White House race as well. You know, we started off 2020 thinking it was going to go one way, and we ended up in a completely different place in just a matter of months. And as you can see, in January, the issues were the economy, healthcare, and impeachment. Impeachment was going on. We were actually talking about how much that was going to matter, looking at historical. You will notice that impeachment has not been mentioned at all in the past months. Instead, we now have COVID, the coronavirus crisis, which has both an economic component and a healthcare component, and then also the emerging issue of law and order and public safety in the aftermath of protests and the riots in the aftermath of George Floyd's death in Minneapolis on Memorial Day. So that's kind of where we are. taking a quick look at the coronavirus crisis, this is a chart showing the number of people who are very concerned. The blue line is the number of people who are very concerned about getting infected by the coronavirus or having someone they know getting infected. And the orange line is the number of people who are very concerned about the economic impacts of the coronavirus. And you can see when this started, right around March 1st, there was very little concern. and then by April 1st, that basically had both metrics had doubled and have stayed relatively stable over the following 6 or 7 months. The economic concern is about 20 points higher than the concern about the public health concern about infections. But that just sort of gives you a sense of how the coronavirus has really, really become sort of this umbrella that hangs over the two biggest issues in this election, which are the economy and healthcare. So how is the president handling the coronavirus? How does the public think the president is handling? For those of you who are unaware, at Real Clear Politics, one of the things that we are known for is our poll averages. And what we simply do is take polls that are in the field in a contemporaneous period of time and average them. And as many of you know, you will get a poll one day saying one thing, a poll the next day saying something that looks, in some cases, radically different. And we were the inventors, the originators, the creators of the poll average about 18 years ago. And so this represents a number of polls that have been taken over the past 2 or so weeks that national polls taking the temperature of the how the public thinks the president is doing. And you can see, again, looking back on the chart to where this began in early March, the president initially wasn't seen as handling the coronavirus well. There was a period in April where his approval rating was positive. That lasted for about 2 weeks, and he has been underwater, as they say, with his approval higher than his disapproval higher than his approval since basically the middle of April. Now you can see, though, there has been a slight uptick in just the past week or two. The president's now at 41.8%, which is as good as he's been on that approval number since the end of June. But by and large, you've got a majority of folks disapproving of the way the president has been handling the coronavirus crisis. And obviously, as is the case with everything these days, those numbers are split sharply along partisan lines. Republicans think he's doing a good job of handling a crisis. Democrats think he's doing a terrible job of handling a crisis. And independents are moderately displeased and disapprove of the way the president is handling the crisis. So the next piece is the economy. And again, we've only had three presidents in history that have won re-election with an unemployment rate over 7%. That's FDR, Ronald Reagan, and Barack Obama. And so this is the blue line is Barack Obama, the unemployment rate during his re-election year of 2012. And as you can see, started at 8.3, remained relatively stable over the entire period of the year, finished at 7.9. Barack Obama, the way the election fell that year, by the way, the election was November 6th. And so he got a reading on November 1st, the Friday before his election. And it was a sort of a meh reading. It was up 0.1%, but did manage to keep it under 8%. This year, the election is on November 3rd. Donald Trump will not get a reading of October jobs. He has one more job report to come out. And so the question is, whether this trend continues. As you can see, it's been an unprecedented sort of roller coaster ride from historically low unemployment across the board to historically high unemployment in April and a relatively robust recovery through last month. And again, he'll get one more reading. And if Donald Trump is able to, if that reading is good and the recovery continues, that will be a real asset for the president in his reelection bid. Because, as we can see from the next slide,
his handling of the economy is the only metric on which the public approves of Trump's handling of issues. If you go across the board, and we'll have another slide on this in a minute, this has been the president's strong suit from the beginning. And certainly, again, going back in this chart to the beginning of the coronavirus crisis when it hit, his net approval on the economy was 16%. And you can see by mid-August that had deteriorated to a point where it was basically a 50-50. But he has, again, seen a bit of recovery in the past few weeks on the issue of the economy. Now at back over 50% for the first time, again, since June, and disapproval down to 46%. So fairly positive, you know, movement for President Trump on this issue. As I said, it's one of the most important issues. And it's the only issue in which he is favored over Joe Biden. I should also add, not coincidentally, the president's overall job approval has also seen some recovery in the past few weeks, and that obviously makes sense, to the point where he's now back up to in the mid-40s, which is a place that he hasn't been since May or so. The next slide will show you, as I mentioned, oh, I'm sorry, the next slide is the law and order public health issue or public safety issue. And it's really, I should say, should have said at the outset, this election is really sort of uncharted territory in the sense that, you know, we've had an election during an economic crisis before. We've had an election during a pandemic before. We've had election during civil unrest before, but we've never had a pandemic or never had an election in the middle of all three. And certainly not with a president as uniquely polarizing as this one. And so as we look to the issue of law and order and public safety, police reform, et cetera, that has emerged over the past few months, and in particular since the conventions, the rioting in Kenosha, the stuff that's been going on in Portland, a lot of this, again, it depends on what you're seeing and what your political perspective is. If this is the image that you have most resonates with you over what you've seen over the past few months, there's a certain section of the country that sees that. Another section of the country is seeing the following image, which is the looting and the rioting and arson. It makes a huge difference because if you're seeing the picture on the left, peaceful protests, 71%, 72% of people support peaceful protests. Conversely, if you're more inclined to see the riots and the violence, 71%. So nearly opposite. And again, that all depends on your personal political perspective. It is difficult to understand exactly how the public is digesting all of these things at the same time. As I mentioned, and this is from a couple different polls that were taken recently, CNN, Quinnipiac, the economy, again, the only issue, this poll had Trump only up by 1 point. As I mentioned, on average, he's up now over 4 percentage points on the issue of the economy and who people trust to handle that issue more. But on other issues, including the issue of keeping Americans safe from harm, Joe Biden has a lead. Again, on the public safety issue, it's smallish, a slim majority, 51%. On other issues like the coronavirus response, healthcare, racial inequality, much larger leads for Joe Biden. So how does that translate into where we are now, 48 days from Election Day? This is a look at our Real Clear Politics average of national polls. And again, this was just updated earlier this morning. That number, it's actually changed. It's actually down to 6.2 percentage points. So we've seen even more tightening just here in the past 24 hours. But as you can see, Biden with a pretty substantial lead. It's been pretty stable over time. There were no bump for really either folks out of the convention. Trump might have gotten a little bounce out of his convention, but it was short-lived and sort of dissipated rather quickly. Joe Biden, at this point in the race, is 5.1 percentage points ahead of where Hillary Clinton was on this day 4 years ago. So he has certainly is in a better position nationally than Hillary Clinton was at this point in the race. So let's take a look at how those numbers break down and which groups Joe Biden is showing strength with and which groups he's showing some weakness with. On the left are the 2016 exit polls. So those were basically the results from 2016 versus, you know, an average of polls that were taken, most recent polls, national polls. And you can see Trump has lost some ground with men overall. And Joe Biden is doing basically the same as Hillary Clinton was doing with women. Next category is age. It's been a really interesting development. You can see that there was questions about whether Joe Biden would do well with younger voters. He seems to be doing fine with younger voters, in fact, better than Hillary Clinton was doing during 2016. Most interestingly, though, he's doing better with older voters. And you can see a 14-point swing between – this is a group that Donald Trump won by 7 percentage points over Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. Now Joe Biden is leading among seniors. This is a real problem. I think it mostly has to do with the coronavirus because of how it impacted that age group in particular. Joe Biden has done better. He's done well, did well with older voters, particularly in the Democratic primary, older African-American voters. But it is a weak spot for Donald Trump. He needs to regain ground with this group over the next 48 days. Next category, race. And this is, you probably heard a lot of talk about this. Joe Biden was in Florida yesterday trying to shore up his Hispanic numbers, and you can see why. He's doing 15 points worse than Hillary Clinton fared in 2016. Still got a 23-point lead. But, again, these are national numbers, and it really depends on how this vote is breaking down in the states that matter. In Arizona, for example, Joe Biden is doing as well as Hillary Clinton did. Donald Trump is right about where he was in 2016. Donald Trump is currently losing that state. In Florida, though, recent polls have shown Donald Trump actually beating Biden among Hispanics, crushing Biden among Cuban Americans in Miami-Dade, for example. The Biden campaign has talked about how they have made huge investments in Hispanic media, but it does not seem to be paying any dividends. At least it hasn't to this point. Among African Americans, another key constituency for Joe Biden, he's not doing as well as Hillary Clinton. And this was a real sore spot for Clinton in 2016 as well. She did not get the same kind of turnout that Barack Obama did, particularly in places like Milwaukee and Detroit and Philadelphia. And again, in those swing states, it really cost her. Now, Joe Biden's facing sort of a similar situation, and it's one that the campaign is working to rectify and try and turn around here in the final 7 weeks. Next group. We have whites with college degrees and without. Now, this was one of the interesting – one of the major shifts in 2016 was this white – whites without college degrees shifted rather dramatically to Donald Trump, as you see. He won them by 37 percentage points. It was something that a lot of the pollsters didn't account for, sort of missed a little bit. They didn't weight their polls for education. Some of them did. Some of them didn't. And so a lot of these voters who had voted for Barack Obama in 2008 or 2012 shifted their votes to Donald Trump. Still holding on to that group, but just not as tightly. As you can see, he's trailing where he was in 2016. Meanwhile, Biden has made big strides with whites with college degree, and this speaks to the Democratic strengths or, conversely, Trump's weakness in the suburbs. White college-educated voters had been traditionally Republican voters, but that was another big shift that took place in 2016, and those trends seem to be holding true 4 years later. And last but not least, ideology. You can see here Biden is exactly where Hillary Clinton was in terms of holding Democratic support. Trump is basically where he was in terms of holding Republican support. But among independents, a group that Donald Trump won by 4 points in 2016, he's now trailing Joe Biden by 8. Again, according to – this is an average of the most recent national polls. But as I – constantly remind people, we do not have a national election. We have 50 state elections. And so this is where we really need to bore down and look at where this race stands in the states that are going to matter. There are anywhere from, if you're being generous, you could go up to 10 battleground states. But really, we're focused on we call them the big six, and they're listed on the screen here. Arizona is, and you can see here Biden leads across the board in these states, anywhere from less than 1 percentage point in North Carolina, all the way up to 6.8% in Wisconsin. He is faring a little better than Hillary Clinton was. If you take an average of Biden's lead in these six battleground states, he's about a point and a half better than Hillary Clinton was in the same six battleground states 4 years ago. I went back and looked to see how Donald Trump performed in these states in 2016. And, he overperformed his polls in five of these six states, including Florida by 1 percentage point, North Carolina by 2.7, Michigan by 3.7, Pennsylvania by 2.6, and Wisconsin by 7.2. So it just gives you a sense. If for the sake of argument, we think that Donald Trump is going to have the same kind of overperformance in these states this time around as he did 4 years ago, all of these states, with the exception of Arizona, where he underperformed by half a percentage point, all of these states are Trump is either winning slightly or trailing slightly. And as you can see, by the way that I'm framing this, I think this election is going to be very, very close. There are certainly scenarios where it's a blowout in favor of Joe Biden. In fact, as I mentioned, Biden's leading in all of those states. So if you actually take a look at the electoral map, which is on your screen now, and you allocate the states based on where our Real Clear Politics averages currently stand, you would see that it would be, in fact, a pretty robust electoral victory for Joe Biden. He would win Florida, North Carolina. He would win Ohio. He would win all of those upper Midwest states back. He would also win Arizona. And you're looking at a 352 electoral victory. But as I said, a lot of these states are, again, within a point or two. So if you take a look, another way to look at the map and how I tell people that they should approach this election is, this is the electoral map from 2016. It's not Joe Biden. It's how it actually ended up with Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump won. He has basically, he can lose 36 electoral votes, okay, and still win the election at 270 to 268. You can see, obviously, Michael Bloomberg just committed $100 million to defeating Trump in the state of Florida, and you can see why. Without Florida, Donald Trump, really has no path to 270 because 29 of his 36 votes would be gone. The only other state he could actually lose and still win would be Iowa. But even then, if he loses Florida, it's pretty much game over. But if you take for the sake of argument and just assume that Donald Trump wins Florida and holds on to North Carolina, and just assume he's going to, win in Ohio and Iowa, where he's currently, I think, trailing in Ohio. We don't have any real recent polling for Ohio, but trailing narrowly in Ohio, and I think leading slightly in Iowa. But then you're left with a situation where you have the three upper Midwest states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Donald Trump could lose two of those three states and still win the Electoral College. Any two of those states he could lose. He could lose Pennsylvania and Michigan. That's 36. That would put him right at 270. And then we would be looking at Nebraska, Nebraska's second congressional district, and Maine's second congressional district, each of which are worth a single vote. He could lose, obviously any combination. When you factor Arizona into this equation, where Trump is trailing by about 4.5 points and where, again, he underperformed his polls, in 2016, then you could say that Trump could lose any two of those four states. And, you've got a situation where if he wins Pennsylvania, Donald Trump does, but loses Michigan, Wisconsin, and Arizona, that's 37 electoral votes, and you end up with a 269-269 tie, which is certainly not out of the question, and the way 2020 has been going might actually be the sort of Murphy's Law situation that we find ourselves in November. But again, I think this election is going to be, given how the public has so deeply divided on issues, I believe this election is going to be very, very close. Next slide. Let me see how I'm doing on time here. Let's take a look at the Senate races. We've got a few minutes here. So the current makeup of the Senate is 53-47 for Republicans. So Democrats need to win a net gain of three seats and the White House, in which case Kamala Harris as vice president would be the tie-breaking vote in favor of Democrats. Or if they fail to win the White House, they would need a net gain of four seats. As you can see here, these are the ones that are colored are the ones that are currently we see project those as leaning one way or the other. So Doug Jones in Alabama, that seat is likely moving to be a Republican pickup in November. And that really complicates Democrats' path because now they have to win an extra seat to offset that. They are in good shape, however, in Arizona, where Martha McSally is trailing Mark Kelly by 9 percentage points, according to our latest average. In Colorado, which we don't have much polling there, but given the blue lean of that state in a presidential election year, that state is also looking like a very likely pickup for Democrats. Beyond that, you look to the states that are considered true toss-ups. North Carolina, where Cal Cunningham is currently leading the incumbent Tom Tillis there. The last couple polls in that race, there have been a couple polls in the past week showing that narrowing to a one-point race. Our average in North Carolina, Cunningham was leading by 9 percentage points just a few weeks ago. So that race has closed rather significantly. Susan Collins in Maine is trailing her opponent by 4.5 percentage points. And as a matter of fact, just before we came on this call, there was a new poll that came out from Quinnipiac showing her trailing by 12 points. So that number has actually changed. Gotten worse for Susan Collins just in the past 30 minutes or so. Other races that are considered toss-ups or very competitive are Montana, where Steve Daines, the Republican, is leading by a slim percentage. Iowa, Joni Ernst, is currently trailing her challenger by less than a half a percentage point. Michigan, where Gary Peters, the Democratic incumbent, that's another race that Democrats is really the only other race that Democrats are really looking closely at and have any sort of real concerns about at this point. And then Georgia, David Perdue is running against John Ossoff and is currently leading by 4.3%. I will point out, again, these polls that just came out, Quinnipiac, they showed Lindsey Graham in a tie in South Carolina with Jamie Harrison, who they had this poll. They had a poll that they did at the end of July, beginning of August, that also had this race a tie. But it was considered, I think, a bit of an outlier because we hadn't seen anything like that. It was 7 points more favorable to the Democrats than anything we'd seen. So they have just, as of this morning, replicated that result. They have it at 48-48 tie. They have Donald Trump leading South Carolina by only 6 percentage points, which is very, very soft for a very, very red state. So that's another one that Republicans are, I think, worried about. It's on their radar screen. I think they believe Lindsey Graham will pull that out. Another race that people often ask me about is Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. The Quinnipiac poll that came out this morning shows him leading Amy McGrath by 12 percentage points, so and Trump's leading Kentucky by 20. So I think that race is pretty much off the table in terms of Democrats thinking that would be a pickup opportunity. So again, if you go to our site, we have a Real Clear Politics Senate map, and we have a feature called the No Toss Up Map, and this allocates the states based on where our current Real Clear Politics averages are. And as you can see, if the election were held today and the poll averages were exactly on, down to 0.3%, which they won't be, but if they were, this is what the map would look like. Joni Ernst would lose in Iowa. Cory Gardner, Martha McSally, Tom Tillis, and Susan Collins would all lose. And Doug Jones would lose in Alabama. And there's your net gain of 4 seats. Now, for people who follow politics and understand sort of the history of how these things work, it really does come down to who has the better night at the top of the ticket. You know, somebody's going to have a good night. It's either going to be Joe Biden, in which case he will win all these competitive states, these battleground states, and he will most likely drag all of his, bring with him a lot of these senators. It's conversely, if Donald Trump has a good night and Republicans, you can bet that Joni Ernst is going to win in Iowa. Tom Tillis is going to win in North Carolina. Susan Collins may even pull it out in Maine. So I think it's going to be very unlikely that those Senate races, the 6 toss-up Senate races, are just going to split 3-3. It's even more unlikely that Democrats would be able to win 4 Senate seats without winning the White House. If Joe Biden loses, the odds of them winning all of these Senate seats is minuscule. In 2016 was the first time in history not a single state voted one way for president and another way for Senate. So every state that voted for Hillary Clinton voted for a Democratic senator, and every state that voted for Donald Trump voted for a Republican senator. There's very little ticket splitting that goes on anymore these days. And so for that reason, all these Senate races are tied pretty closely, or most of them, I should say, are going to be driven by what happens at the top of the ticket. Real quickly on the House, the magic number there, and I didn't have a slide on this, but I'll just touch on it quickly. The magic number there is 20. There are about 36 or so competitive House seats. Most of them are in suburban districts around the country, including there are about 4 seats in Texas that Republicans are defending, suburbs of Houston and Dallas. There are a couple seats in Georgia, the suburbs of Atlanta. We've got a couple in the state of Illinois. A bunch of the seats that Democrats won in California are going to be in play again. And so, I think this will be a situation where you have, we did have an interesting and sort of unique result in 2018 where Democrats basically had a blue wave at the House level and Republicans had sort of a mini red wave at the Senate level. That was a sort of bifurcation that I don't think a lot of folks really saw coming. It's possible we could see something like that again, but I really do think in a presidential election year, you're going to see, whatever happens at the top of the ticket is going to have real consequences down ticket in some of these House races. I don't know, even if Republicans have a good night, whether they would have enough. I know some Republicans think they would have enough to get to that magic number and win back control of the House. But again, if this is a really close election, it seems unlikely they'd be able to make those sorts of gains. And so lastly, just looking ahead, and I hate to end on a downer note, but this is it. Steve, go ahead. So I think we're in for a real train wreck of an election in terms of, and I hope I'm wrong, because, with the mail-in balloting that's going to go on, and set aside whether you think that invites fraud and abuse or not, just from the logistical issues, you've got all these county clerks that are going to be receiving, mail-in ballots 10 times, 20 times what they're normally used to, that they're not equipped for. A lot of them by law can't even start opening them until the polls close on election night. So if this is a situation where you have really close elections in a lot of these states, both at the presidential level, the Senate level, I think we're going to see, we won't know who the winner is on election night in some of these states, perhaps. And there will be, there will be election challenges. And I think we're really in for a situation where, if it's a close election, half the country is going to walk away. the losing side is going to walk away and think that this thing was stolen. Both sides are actively undermining the integrity of the outcome on November 3rd. Democrats are saying, you know, Republicans are taking up mailboxes and, you know, doing all sorts of things, and they will cry voter suppression. They will say that there were all sorts of Republican efforts to cancel ballots. And conversely, if Trump loses in a close election, you will have all of his supporters that think that it was fraud and abuse. So now, again, I hope I'm wrong. And a lot of this is moot if it is a landslide scenario where, you know, if just for example, if Biden does have a great night and he wins places like Texas and Georgia and, you know, all these states, then it will be a moot point whether it's a few thousand votes in Michigan or Wisconsin. But if it is close, I think it's going to be very contentious, very nasty, and it'll be Florida 2000 on steroids. And this speaks more to you all, and I know you'll talk more about policy and what this means for your businesses. But if Democrats do take control of the White House and they do manage to take control of the Senate, they're already talking openly about doing away with the filibuster. I think it'll be the first thing that they do, and that will open the floodgates for big ticket agenda items on taxes, on immigration, on healthcare. I mean, you name it. And I think the Democrats will be sort of off to the races in terms of an aggressive policy push if they take control in November. And then if Trump wins, what will the next 4 years look like under a Donald Trump who won re-election? Setting aside his talk about having, you know, three terms or four terms, and setting aside the idea that, like, if he loses, he's not going to leave the White House. He's going to barricade himself in there. I don't even want to go there. But just if Trump wins, what will the future look like? Will he be unbound? Will he be able to do what will he be able to do in terms of policy using and sort of pushing, continuing to push the boundaries of his executive authorities, especially if it's a situation where Democrats maintain control of the House? Because I don't need to tell anyone on this call, I'm sure, that Washington is exceptionally dysfunctional at the moment. Part of that is election related, but some of it's not. And I don't think, after November 3rd, people are going to wake up on November 4th and be in a real sort of kumbaya sort of mentality. I think it's going to be – so Trump will, I think, continue to push the boundaries of what he can do through his executive authority. So with that, I'd love to take some questions. I know we ran a little bit long. I hope that's not a problem, but go ahead, Steve.
Yes. So as I mentioned at the top of the call, on the right side of your webinar screen, there is a chat box where you can type in a question. We've already been getting some questions during the course of the presentation. And just, Tom, looking at those questions quickly, it seems like a number of them focus on the accuracy of polls. I know you kind of touched on that indirectly with your remarks on by how much various candidates outperformed or underperformed their polling numbers on election night. But what's been the thinking on the accuracy of polls at different points in advance of election day?
Well, I'll reiterate, because I got asked this question an awful lot after, in the 4 years between 2016 and now. And I, going back to 2016, excuse me, and I said this in January, I've said this a lot of times, the polls weren't as bad as I think people thought. And it was actually the pundits that were awful. The national polls, our final Ripley Politics average had Hillary Clinton winning by 3.3%. She won by 2.1. That differential, 1.2%, is better than and more accurate than races, any of the previous races, including 2012 and some of the other races. Some of the polls in 2018 were pretty darn good, pretty solid. But in 2016, you couldn't turn on the TV or your computer or radio without having some so-called expert saying, with this faux statistical certainty that it was a 99.256% chance that Hillary Clinton had this thing in the bag. And these were not, cranks. These were David Plouffe. Obama's former campaign manager, you know, professors from Princeton University, well-respected election observers and pundits that were constantly harping on the fact that based on what they were seeing, that this election was sort of in the bag. And quite frankly, they were filtering the data through their own prism when there was plenty of evidence out there that the race was much more competitive than people were letting on. I'm seeing some of that this time around. I do worry that there, you know, we could have some polling error. But I'm not certain about that. I mean, some pollsters, as I mentioned, they have changed their methodology. They are accounting for education not enough, in my opinion. And I do think, you know, one of the things we saw this happen, I'm going to be watching very carefully to see whether there is tightening in the polls, you know, heading into election and where we end up. Because right now it looks like, you know, Biden's got a fairly stable lead, but the campaigns are not acting like Biden has a 7-point lead nationally. They are not acting like he's got a 7-point lead in Wisconsin. That's not how this race feels to me. And so you've got some pollsters that are just now moving from registered voters to likely voters. And so I guess that's a long-winded answer. I generally, you know, trust polls, but I also try and make sure that I'm looking at other information. I'm looking at the generic congressional ballot, for example. I think I mentioned this in January as well. This is one of the things that went unremarked upon, is that the generic congressional ballot, this is the question that pollsters ask, national surveys ask. If the election were held today, who would you vote for, the Democrat or the Republican? No names attached, just Democrat or Republican. And, you know, 4 years ago, Democrats had a 6.2 percentage point lead in the middle of October. On election day, that lead had collapsed to 0.6%, so less than 1%. So something dramatic was happening in shifting in public opinion, but it basically went unremarked upon. Republicans ended up winning that national House vote by, I think, 1.1%. So there were indications, there was evidence out there where you could very easily craft the scenario where Donald Trump could win that election. But again, most of the pundits didn't. So, and I'm sensing some of that this time around too. And I urge everybody who's listening, keep a close eye on how these polls move in the final days of this race. Because even polls, you know, 7 weeks out now are not necessarily indicative of where this race might be in a few weeks. And again, it's not indicative, in my opinion, of how the campaigns are currently operating and what they're doing and how they're reacting.
Okay, so let me follow up on that. There's actually a bunch of really interesting questions. Some of them are actually about polling methodology. I mean, it must be difficult to get responses from voters these days, especially to inbound calls from or inbound emails from parties that they may not know. Has that changed the quality of polling at all, or have pollsters figured out a way of getting around those issues?
By and large, pollsters have done a pretty good job at adapting to the shift from landlines to cellular phones, and it's become obviously a lot more expensive because, you know, in terms of pollsters used to be able to make 5,000 calls to be able to get 1,000 respondents. Now they have to make 50,000 calls to get 500 respondents. So it's much more labor intensive, particularly if you are doing a live dial where you have an actual interviewer on the other end, as opposed to a robocall or an IVR, interactive voice response is the official name, where it's you pick up the phone and it says press 1 if you support Donald Trump, press 2 if you support Joe Biden. So pollsters have by and large, I think, done a pretty good job of adapting. You've seen some pollsters move to online polling, which is something that, you know, the technology on that is getting better each cycle. It's still not to where we do not include online polls in our averages unless they are backed by a major media organization. right? So, for example, you've got, you know, Reuters, Ipsos, you know, Economist, YouGov, I think, and some of these others. But so the technology is changing. What it comes down to at the end of the day, though, is pollsters have these responses, right? They have, let's say, 500 valid responses, 1,000 valid responses. They still, at that point, they still take the data and they say, okay, what is the election? What is the electorate going to look like on election day? I need to, they're extrapolating those responses to what they think the turnout model, and they look, they base it on, you know, what did the exit polls look like in 2016 and in 2012, and how did these different demographic groups perform, right? And so what's the current population? I need, I've got 12% African American, so my responses are only 4%, so I'm you know, I'm going to weight these responses to match these different demographics. So it's, polling is still, in that sense, more of an art than a science in terms of pollsters need to make their best educated guess about who they think is going to turn out on election day, what the electorate is going to look like. And if they, if they're, they don't do a good job of that, that's when you see, you know, real discrepancies between the final results and what the pre-election polls were. And again, they're grappling with that. And you know, some are doing it better than others, but, you know, I think by and large, they've done a pretty good job to this point, but there have been some misses. There's no question about that.
Okay. Follow up. One more, I guess, on what you may be seeing in the polling, and then I'll get, I'll ask some questions that are maybe more policy or opinion oriented. Between election day and certification of the results, I mean, in your last remark, you suggested that Florida 2000 will look like, you know, a debutante party. Are you picking up any signals, any concerns? Are you seeing anything in either direct polling on the issue or indirect polling about the potential timeline between election day and certification?
No, not. I mean, again, it's going to depend on how this all plays out. I mean, and the legal challenges and all that. I will say, I do think we could be in a situation where this thing, you know, there are particular cases could end up like Florida going to the state Supreme Court and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court in a sort of, you know, massively expedited fashion. There also has been talk about, and we saw this play out a little bit in 2016. I think it will, if it's a close election, we will also see this effort to convert the sort of faithless electors, right? Which would be cause all sorts of, you know, wreak havoc on the system as well. So I don't know anything about the actual date of certification. But I mean, I do think we're in for a really rough ride post November 3rd. Again, I hope I'm wrong. I really do, because I think it's really, the country's already divided, and I suspect this will only exacerbate the rending of our civic fabric, if, you know, with the sort of animosity that could go on in these sorts of contested situations. But I think that's where we're headed.
Okay, let me pivot and ask a few questions about process and policy opinions, just based on all of the spectating that you're doing right now on the political process. So there's been lots of discussion of early voting. Obviously, vote by mail, it means that the decision day is not actually a day, but it gets stretched over a period of time. How is that changing, if it is at all, the tactics that, you know, House, Senate, White House campaigns are using to run their campaigns in this cycle?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so we are, I mean, everything about this election is unique, from the way that we're having a campaign, you know, I guess we're starting to have some rallies now, but basically didn't for a period of 6 months, to virtual conventions, to the actual mechanism for which we're going to conduct this election, which is, you know, a massive push for vote by mail. So some states do it already and have right? And early voting has been around with us for many, many election cycles, and the campaigns are very attuned to when different states, you know, are allowed to start voting, and they all have their get out the vote efforts keyed and teed up to coincide with those when states start to vote. The further issue about the mail-in voting, right, and there's this issue of let's take ballot harvesting, for example, which is going on in California. It goes on in Arizona. Some of these other states have allowed it, which is where you can now have campaign operatives, right, who can go out and collect a bunch of ballots from, you know, voters and basically take those ballots and return them to the clerk's office, election office. We saw that in 2018, and this is what I think, this is where Republicans really, you know, they have an issue with that. And it's one of those situations where, you know, a lot of Republicans were ahead on election day, on election night, right? And then as the ballots come in over time, the Democrats, you know, you're just watching the tallies as the Democrats, you know, gain and gain and eventually overtake. It's what happened with Kyrsten Sinema in the Senate race in Arizona. It's what happened in a lot of these House races in Southern California. And so I think we're going to see that in a lot of these states. And certainly Republicans are now trying to do their own version of ballot harvesting, right? Those are the rules. And so they're going to play by them, even though they don't like them, and think that they're, you know, ripe for fraud and abuse. I mean, polling shows that I think about 3/4 of Trump voters, Republican voters, plan to vote in person on election day. They are not going to mess around with absentee ballots, with mail-in ballots, none of that. They're going to go to the polls. Conversely, you've got about 60% in one of the polls that I saw of Democrats say they are going to vote by mail. They're going to vote absentee. And so I think we are set up for a situation where, you know, you've got, you know, Donald Trump voters turn out on election day. He runs up big margins. And then you've got these county clerks that are counting ballots in all of these states that, you know, Trump banned to eventually lose those states over time. And that's one of those things that, you know, it's going to cause just massive. I mean, there'll be calls that the election is rigged and on and on. But I think both campaigns are certainly preparing in advance of that. And then the stories are out there, you know, that both campaigns have hired, you know, legions of lawyers that will be, you know, looking over these ballots on election day, poll watchers, but also, you know, to file legal challenges, et cetera, et cetera. So I think both campaigns are sort of are loaded for bear. I don't know if that exactly answers the question, but certainly we're in a different landscape.
How about a couple of comments on get out the vote strategies this year? I have a question here. Somebody is asking, apparently, there's a story that, you know, the Biden campaign is really not investing as much, at least as they might traditionally, in door-to-door. And, you know, they are pursuing other tactics. What does the magnitude and strategies of the Get Out the Vote effort look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So there was this story the other day that, you know, the Trump campaign, they're knocking on millions of doors, right? They are, and this is one of the things that I think is a bit, even though Trump is trailing in the polls, you know, it's a bit underplayed that, you know, he won his election in 2016. He had no campaign staff. He really didn't spend any money. He had hundreds of millions of dollars spent against him. They were, even in the final days of that campaign, basically sort of running it on a shoestring. This time around, when you talk to the campaign, they have all these metrics about how many volunteers they have on the ground in 17 states. They've got an army of folks that are out knocking on doors and doing all these things. And the Biden campaign is not doing that. They are taking a different tack, which is, you know, almost all virtual. They're doing virtual fundraisers. He's not really doing rallies. They're not out knocking on doors. They're really pushing via social media to try and, you know, get folks. You saw Barack Obama just released a video this morning, I think, telling, you know, young voters to how to get out and how to vote basically by mail and urging them to do that. So it really is a pretty stark difference in terms of how the campaigns are approaching the vote in November. Traditionally, there are studies that show that voter contact, personal voter contact, like knocking on a door and actually talking to a voter and handing them a piece of literature, is vastly more impactful than a phone call or an email or whatever. And in particular, if that person who's knocking on your door is someone who's known to you, is a neighbor, is a friend, it's even more impactful to that person. So historically speaking, if I were, I would say the Trump strategy should, based on, be a stronger strategy. But again, we're in such a unique environment. We have no idea how any of this is going to work out.
Okay. Here's another question. Maybe this is one you can have a little fun with, but any thoughts on potential October surprises?
Well, we've already had two September surprises just in the past week. I don't know what to expect. I mean, this has been such a crazy campaign to begin with. The speed with which the news flows these days is just astonishing. Things that we think are going to be impactful. I mentioned, 8 months ago, we thought we'd be talking about impeachment. It would be a part of the campaign. Nobody's mentioned it in 6 months. We could be in a situation where coronavirus is not even a big issue heading into the election 7 weeks from now. If the numbers go down and who knows? I do think it is clear that there will be many more revelations against Donald Trump, whether it's in tape form or articles, we've seen book after book after book coming out, making all sorts of allegations. So I think we're going to see a few more twists and turns. And there could be other things. There could be, an international event. There could be, something that happened at the debate. There could be a health issue that rises for either of the candidates, quite frankly. I mean, just imagine if one of them gets coronavirus or has some sort of health issue. So I think there's a lot of twists and turns left in this race, but I have no idea what they might actually be.
And I guess we'll make this a last question. Any guess on whether we are going to see this election decided by a court?
Well, I hope not. I can absolutely foresee a situation where one of these legal challenges or multiple legal challenges go to the state Supreme Courts or maybe even the U.S. Supreme Court, a la 2000. But, I think it's certainly possible, but, I just don't know how likely it's going to be. And as far as, anything beyond that, it's just so hard to project what might happen. I don't really have any guesses in that regard, but again, I'll just reiterate, I think this is going to be a really close election. It just has that sense, and I could be wrong, but I have a sense that it's going to be close and contentious, and it's not going to be a fun period for the next, in the aftermath of this thing.
Okay, Tom, thanks so much for your thoughts and comments. There were a bunch of questions that we unfortunately couldn't get to, maybe to your relief, about whether we're going to get a new Fed chair, whether there will be civil unrest. We'll save those for another time. But I just want to remind everybody that this is the first of a series. Remember to dial in on Wednesday, November 30th, when Bob Ryan joins us to lay out the impact of Election 2020 on housing finance. Bob served very senior roles at the Federal Housing Finance Agency under both Mel Watt, Democrat, and Mark Calabria, Republican. He's the former chief risk officer at the Federal Housing Administration. He has at least three decades in D.C. around the mortgage and mortgage finance market, so that'll be a great call. And then on Wednesday, October 14th, we'll be joined by Mark Mazur. He's going to help us look at the tax and spending implications of Election 2020. Mark heads the Tax Policy Center in D.C. It's an Urban Institute, Brookings Institution joint venture, and it's probably the country's leading expert on tax and spending policy. So please be sure to join us then. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. There will be a replay available hopefully tomorrow or the day after that. But thanks for your time and attention today, and good luck in the markets. That's it for the APS Portfolio Strategy Call. Bye-bye.